Ohel oko eko ka aha. Inahe kuliana imua okea aha. Ho o kolo kolo ki e ki hano hano oko moko aina o Hawaii. E naoi mai, e malio mai, I lohi ia kaleo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 17898, State of Hawaii versus Keana Aina. Arguing for the petitioner, Victor M. Cox. Arguing for the respondent, Stephen L. Fry, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney. Argument on the merits.
All right, good morning. Aloha, everyone. This proceeding is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel. I want to thank Judge Crabtree for joining the court today. During the proceeding, should a justice have a question, they'll raise their hand and I will call upon them at the earliest opportunity. And I'd like to ask our attorneys to introduce themselves in the order in which they will be arguing. Beginning with Mr. Cox.
Thank you. Good morning. This is Victor Cox, court appointed counsel for the defendant appellant, Samson Keana Aina.
Good morning, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney L. Fry.
All right, very well. Just to confirm, Mr. Cox, you'll have 20 minutes with 10 minutes reserved for rebuttal. Mr. Fry, you'll have 30 minutes to argue with a 5-minute warning, and you'll see a light and a tone at the end of your allotted time. Mr. Cox, please proceed with your argument.
Thank you. On the motion to suppress, I think there's two basic issues involved in this appeal. One is the entry in the first place, and the second one is, even after they made the entry, did the police have the permission to go into Mr. Keana Aina's backpack? On the entry part, there is absolutely zero evidence that the police ever made any kind of knock or announce statement. All they did was yell from some 15 feet away, "Police, exit your tenant, exit your tents." They never went to the doorway to the tent to make any kind of attempt to disclose or state their purpose and appearance and yelling out knock, knock, or demand entry. The claim that somehow they didn't need to do that because the target of the warrant, Michelle Wright, had exited the tent is misleading and not supported by any evidence. There's no indication that Michelle Wright ever gave anybody any permission to go into her residence. The ICA raised the issue of whether the tent was a building, et cetera. I don't think that's really an issue because it's clear that the warrant that was issued was directed to the, quote, residence of Michelle Wright. So the police had a clear obligation to state their appearance and make their demand for entry, which they never did. The claim that Mr. Keana Aina couldn't hear them is also misleading and false in that all that Michelle Wright told the police was that he was hard of hearing. He didn't say he couldn't hear. He said he was hard of hearing. So all the police had to do before they entered was to yell a little louder. They didn't get a response, fine. But the problem is they never made that effort, which is clearly in contravention of the stated rules. The knock and announce is clear. They didn't do that. After entering, well, let me back up. Before entering, they observed two people sleeping on one bed with two backpacks. One, the Hello Kitty, one, a gray camouflage Swiss gear backpack. When they got into the tent, a question?
We have a question from Justice Nakayama, Mr. Cox.
Mr. Cox, can you point me to where in the record it says the police officers observed the two backpacks when standing outside? Where in the record does it show that?
I'm sorry, I can't give you that direct response unless I take a quick look.
All right. Well, how about, when reading the transcript of the motion to suppress, I think you left out that the police, all the witnesses said that the police witnesses said that they said search warrant. They didn't just say get out of your tent. They said, hello, police department, search warrant, come out of your tent. If they said search warrant, well, how do you expect them to do a knock?
I expect them to yell it out like it's set forth in some of the cases. All they had to do, was yell, knock, knock. I understand they're not going to knock on a flap of a tent and create any noise, but the substitute would and should have been a yelling out, knock, knock. That's clear.
You don't think and saying police department, search warrant, what's the purpose of the statute, the knock and announce statute?
It's to prevent injury, prevent destruction of evidence, and prevent somebody from...
To provide notice, right?
Provide notice.
Do you think what they did didn't provide them notice?
I don't think it did for two reasons. Number one is they were yelling this as they approached the tent, the residents of Michelle Wright, and they yelled out, everybody leave your tents, plural, search warrant. There's no indication that that was directed specifically at the residents of Michelle Wright. And when they got to the actual residence, they did nothing but peek in there and then enter, moving a couch and the flap to get it to gain entrance.
Somehow she understood to come out, though, because she came out.
Oh, because the police said, exit your tents.
Okay.
All right. Question from Justice Wilson, Mr. Cox. Oh, you can mute. Justice Wilson, you need to unmute. Sorry. There you go.
Thank you. Mr. Cox, I wanted to ask your help on understanding, I'm sorry, with respect to this issue of the degree to which the knock and announce statute was complied with. You focused on the concept of whether a demand was made. And in Nioli, the Alcourt did specifically state that there are three steps that need to be taken to comply with the demand for entry under 803.37. And one of them is demand for entry. Now, I wanted to ask you about the findings of fact and conclusions of law. Having reviewed it, I was wondering, did the court ever address that issue? That is, did the court ever find that a demand was requested? Because it seems to me that the finding of the circuit court was that 803.37 didn't apply. But I just wanted to be clear with respect to the record.
I don't believe there ever was a finding as to whether a demand was or was not made. They parroted or repeated language that the police, as Justice Nakayama indicated, yelled out, warrant, exit your tents, or search warrant, exit your tents. But I don't believe any finding was ever made as to a demand or announcement as to the purpose.
Thank you.
Mr. Cox, what about the notion that there was enough notice to the police officers that the Swiss attack, that they should have gotten reasonably should have known that was not Ms. Wright's backpack, and that accordingly they should have gotten a warrant. What's your take on that issue?
Well, my take is that I don't think there's any requirement that it has to have his name emblazoned on the backpack. I think the cases that I cited clearly show that something in the vicinity of a person clearly identified or connected to him, especially where there's two backpacks and two people, is enough of an indication of ownership of that particular item. And I think of the comparison case, I think it was, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, Podesky or whatever that was, with a suitcase. The guy has a suitcase laying next to him and it's open. there's no name or anything on it. And they clearly decided that, well, it's right next to this guy. It's his suitcase. And it's the kind of thing that this person would own. So there, it doesn't have to be a name on there. There has to be some indication of ownership. The second part of that is that the warrant, by its specificity, paragraph 4 says that backpacks are okay under the exclusive control of Michelle Wright. This backpack was nowhere near under the control of Michelle Wright. So I think it's just clearly obvious that and logical that it belonged to Mr. Kayana Aina.
All right. Justice McKim.
Mr. Cox, where in the record is the actual search warrant?
I'm sorry, is the actual what?
The actual search warrant. Where in the record can I find it?
It's attached to the opening brief.
Thank you.
As an appendix. I don't know. I think it's appendix 1 to the opening brief.
Thank you.
Mr. Cox, are you advocating for a standard that'll be very hard for police to implement in terms of sorting out, you know, what belongs to whom in this sort of very pressured situation of making entry into a dwelling or a residence in this case? In the Nabarro case, there was very sort of clear indicia that I guess it was Ms. Nabarro had a pocketbook with a purse, which she picked up and then moved towards the bathroom. And this court has said, clear exercise of dominion by her over that bag, which was enough to put the officers on notice. There really isn't anything that dramatic in this case. Are you, help me understand how the rule that you're advocating for here would be something that police could readily apply these kinds of circumstances and understand the difference between what belongs to one person and another. Oh, you're on mute. I'm sorry, Mr. Cox. Got to unmute. Oh, Mr. Cox, you need to unmute. Mr. Cox.
Oh, okay. Can you hear me now?
We can.
Okay. I'm sorry. I don't know what happened. Some screen popped up and I don't know what happened. Sorry. Anyway, I think in the instant case that it's an issue of common sense, of reasonableness. If you have two people on the same bed, two backpacks, one clearly identified as a Hello Kitty female type backpack and one a camouflage swish gear backpack, I don't think it takes an enormous amount of common sense to say, wait, one belongs to the other and the other one belongs to the male. They're both there. So I don't think I'm trying to raise the bar for the police to try to make an instant decision in some emergency situation. Plus, this was not an emergency situation. The person that was attached to the backpack was asleep. So.
Okay. Justice Nakayama had a follow-up.
Mr. Cox, Nabarro specifically says, without notice of some sort of ownership of a belonging, the police are entitled to assume that all objects within the premises lawfully subject to the search warrant can be executed upon. Why can't one person have two backpacks? And surely you're not saying the pink one has to belong to the woman. I assume you're not saying that. But why can't one person have two backpacks? I have two backpacks. I mean, I don't...
I think a person certainly can have two backpacks, but I think in this instance, when the search warrant with its specificity language says under the exclusive control of Michelle Wright, and again, with two people on the same bed with two backpacks, I don't think it's a logical conclusion to decide that both of them belong to one or the other. It was clear to me, at least I think it should be clear, that there was two people, two backpacks, they each owned one. And the one that they searched illegally was not under the control of Michelle Wright.
Justice McKenna has a follow-up. Justice McKenna.
Mr. Cox, you were talking about the specificity of the search warrant, but I noticed that one of the arguments of counsel below was that this was actually an unconstitutional general warrant, as it allows search of the residence of Michelle Wright, described as a homeless campsite consisting of various color and size tarpaulins at the Old Kona Airport Beach Park. And it allowed search of, including but not limited to, all rooms, boxes, toolboxes, suitcases, handbags, safes, within said camp and or stored outside near the camp. And I noticed that the findings of fact indicate that as the police officers entered the campsite, they were yelling a search warrant, police search warrants, and telling people to exit their tents. And a lot of, I guess, various people came out, and they actually checked each of them to see whether they had outstanding warrants. But I don't see that argument in your certiorari application. So am I to assume that you are waiving that argument at this point?
I'm sorry, waiving the argument about?
This being a general search warrant that allowed search of the entire campsite. The police, as they entered, were yelling, police search warrants. And they were checking other people to see whether they, who they were and whether they had outstanding warrants.
Well, I guess my answer is that I'm not concerned about these other people. If somebody had been arrested or property taken from other people, then I would think, yes, I would be arguing
you're no longer, trial counsel below argued that this was an unconstitutional general warrant, but you are not raising that argument on certiorari or on appeal. Is that correct?
I'm not making it from the standpoint of it applying as a total general warrant. I am making it from the standpoint that this particular warrant being for a residence that didn't allow them to go into the property of a visitor.
How do you, the trial court, however, made a finding that neither the detective nor any of the officers were aware that the backpack inside of the tent belonged to your client, or whether any particular backpack belonged to the defendant. What is your argument that that finding of fact is clearly erroneous?
Well, again, the argument is based on the circumstances of this case, where you have two people on the same bed, two backpacks. One, and I agree with Justice Nakayama, just because it says Hello Kitty doesn't necessarily mean it belongs to a woman. But when you have a woman there and a man there and a camouflage and a Hello Kitty, and the indication was that the police opened the Hello Kitty bag at the location and determined that did belong to Michelle Wright, then I think the conclusion is inescapable that the other one belonged to Mr. Keanu Aina. And the fact that the trial court didn't make or made a different determination or didn't make a determination isn't binding on this court, because it was a motion to suppress. So I think this court can take the facts as they are.
Are you saying that this court takes de novo review of a trial court's findings of fact on a motion to suppress? I thought it was a clearly erroneous standard. What is the law on that issue?
Well, I don't think this court is bound by that finding.
You're saying that this court makes de novo findings of facts on a motion to suppress on appellate review?
I think this court can determine that the trial court's finding was erroneous, yes.
All right. Justice Wilson had a follow-up.
Thank you. Mr. Cox, I also am interested in your view of the facts in the record with respect to the period of time when the search of the packs were taking place. And specifically, you alluded to it, but to the extent that you can tell from the record, how chronologically did the search of the packs proceed? In other words, do you know whether the Hello Kitty pack was searched before or after the gray pack?
I can't honestly say that, Mr. Justice. I don't think it's in the record. I didn't see the timing, but I did see that the Hello Kitty pack was opened in while still in the tent. So I don't know the sequence.
And you mentioned the gray pack and the Hello Kitty pack being on the bed where the defendant and Ms. Wright were. But where in relation to the defendant was that gray pack specifically?
My understanding is that it was approximately 1 to 2 feet away from him on the bed.
Okay, and with respect to that Hello Kitty backpack, do you have an idea how close that was to the defendant?
I do not.
Okay, thank you.
Anything further at this time, Mr. Cox, or do you want to reserve your time for rebuttal?
We just had the other issues of the juror excuse and the...
Oh, please, call in if you'd like to argue those issues. I'm sorry. I thought you'd stop speaking because I thought you were fine with your argument, but please go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, just briefly on the failure to excuse the juror, I think the main point that I tried to make is that between the time that the juror was initially questioned or raised her concerns about her bias, prejudice, interest, and the time she was ultimately discharged or excused, absolutely nothing happened. And the court never went back and to find out, well, what did you say to the other jurors? What happened? You know, nothing changed. So she should have been excused at the outset and not been allowed to consider evidence. And I understand she didn't get into the deliberation, and I see my yellow light is on. So basically on the listening to the testimony by allowing the prosecutor to ask my client questions about all of his knowledge of illegal substances, et cetera, was improper. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Cox. At this point, we'll turn to Mr. Fry for your argument.
Thank you, Chief Justice Rechtemold, Associate Justices. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. I think the most important element of this case is whether or not this search fell within the bounds of 803.37. When the ICA drafted their memorandum opinion, they said that this fell outside the scope of 803.37, but the police complied with its requirements anyway. And whether or not that's the right analysis to follow, you can look at I believe it's Diaz in the case where a search was conducted of a commercial premises and the police breached an interior door. The court decided that fell outside the requirements of 803.37. And so instead of requiring the police to comply with the knock and announce statutory requirements, you look at the constitutional protections of the Fourth Amendment and you can go through that analysis. But either way, what's clear in this case is that the police did everything they could to comply with a notice, with proper notice to the individuals that were being searched. They walked up to the tent, they made clear demands and announced their presence. They said police, they said search warrant, and they asked for the individuals to exit their tent. When you're analyzing whether or not the request to exit the tent was a demand for entry, other things that have been determined to be demands for entry is to open the door. Exiting the tent would necessarily require the individuals in the tents to come out and open whatever entry they had. Now, there was the question of whether or not the lower court or the trial court found that a demand for entry was made. And in the transcript of the motion to suppress hearing at page 61, that's conceded in questioning to the officers that the officers say that they never made a demand for entry. But whether or not asking individuals in the tents to exit qualifies as a demand for entry is certainly something that shouldn't be overlooked.
We have three questions. I had one quick one, and then I'll turn to Justice Wilson and McKenna. Is there anything in the record to indicate why the officers didn't demand to entry, and specifically any suggestion that their safety might have been compromised by entering this limited space before the folks had exited, or is there nothing on that point?
I don't think there's a specific testimony as to why they didn't demand entry outside of this. Was the scenario that the officers are going into is a homeless encampment where they believe drug transactions to be occurring. And clearly, I think the reason that they were asking everyone to exit their tents was not because they planned to search the tents of other individuals, which they did not do, but they needed to secure the area. And everyone in the area complied. So they were trying to protect everyone's rights in the best way that they could. And in a scenario where you have soft-sided tarps, there's no enclosures to Michelle Wright and Kiana Ina's tent. There was furniture, as the record shows, there's furniture on the outside boundaries, but there's no clearly defined door, so there could never be a breaking.
All right. Well, Justice Wilson and Justice McKenna had questions. I think Justice Wilson was first by just a bit. So, Justice Wilson. Oh, you need to unmute, Justice Wilson. Sorry.
All right. I'm happy to defer to Justice McKenna if she wants to ask her question first. But all right. I am interested, Mr. Frye, in your view of the effect of not making a demand. I mean, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's clear that the circuit court didn't address the requirement of Neoli that there be compliance with 803.37 by making a demand. And presumably the demand requirement gives the occupants of the residence a chance to do things like maybe identify what is their property or to take the property that's theirs and when they have an opportunity to leave the residence. So I guess specifically my question is, what do you think would be the proper remedy if there was a failure to make demand pursuant to 803.37? What's your view of the proper remedy?
Well, I think to even get to that point where you're requiring the demand to be made, you have to look to 803.37 and meet all the requirements of 803.37. So you have to come to the conclusion that it's a building. And then you have to come to the conclusion that
I'm sorry. I wasn't making clear that I'm giving you a scenario, and I didn't mean for you to have to concede that in your view 803.37 applies. But assuming that it does, would it appear then that in this case the contents of the backpack should have been suppressed?
Well, when you look at Dixon, and you look to a scenario where other things are done besides an express demand for entry. In Dixon, they use the ruse. They approach the door and they use a ruse to allow for the door to be opened. So in this case, the door was opened. Michelle Wright came out. Other individuals came out. And when the officers were at the side of the tent, there's testimony that they were looking into the tent. They could see Kiana in the tent and it was open. So 803.37 in this case, as it's applied, allowed officers to go in because they didn't have to break a door. Now, if they did break a door and there was no demand for entry, the case law is clear that the evidence should be suppressed, but that didn't happen in this case.
Very well. Justice McKenna, your question. Thank you for waiting.
Thank you. So, Mr. Frye, you alluded to the Diaz case in 337. One of the purposes is to protect the right of privacy. And I'm wondering In Naiole, we indicated that we referred to it as a home, and I recognize that the statute does say house, but in terms of your argument that 803.37 does not apply, I'm going to ask, is it your position that there a tent cannot be a house?
I don't think that's my position. I think the 803.37 was written, and it says store, building, or house. And clearly, in this case, the individuals were living under tarps that were tied together.
How old is the statute? Weren't there, at the time the statute was passed, were houses like this, the houses that we have now, with clear doors, with windows that block everything?
Well, I think over the course of history, people have always lived in certainly things that don't necessarily reflect a standard house with doors and windows. The quality of a structure is going to be different. And these people were living in the tent. So I don't think whether or not they had a privacy interest in their structure, even though the walls were not completely enclosed, you could see right into their structure. I think they had it set up, and finding that they had a privacy right is obvious in this case. But finding whether 803.37 applied because this was sufficiently a building isn't so clear. This was little more than an umbrella with furniture to the sides.
Let me ask you this. Let's say that, so you're indicating that this only applies to houses and buildings. So is it your argument then that it would not, 803.37 would not apply to a family living in a trailer house or an RV?
I think that's a house. That would not be my argument. And I'm not trying to argue that 803.37 doesn't apply to this case because it's not a building or a house. I don't think that this court needs to make that finding.
Didn't the ICA hold that 803.37 does not apply?
They did, but I think it's more, and they noted two things. They noted whether or not this was a building, and they put in footnote 4 that that you could look up the common law definition of building or house. And so when you do that, you talk about a structure with walls and entries. And those facts weren't present in this case. You have furniture and you have tarps over top. But what is also important is that there's no doors in this scenario. This wasn't even like a typical tent with flexed poles and a zippered enclosure. It was just tarps. And there was access to go directly into the tent, and Michelle Wright exited the tent. So whatever entry was even there was breached by Michelle Wright's exit. And when they go in to wake up Mr. Kiana Aina, they talk about having to move a futon. Well, a futon is not...
I'm sorry. We're straying from the focus of my question. So... I'm trying to figure out what the line is here. So is it the state's position that if this had been a tent with a zipper, 803.37 would clearly apply, but if it's tarps, and let's say if it's tarps and, you know, like a curtain that's covering the entrance, 803.37 does not apply? I'm trying to figure out what the bright line is here as to the state's position as to when 803.37 would apply to people living in a homeless camp.
I think in this case, the police treated it like 803.37 applied. They treated it like it was a house, and they tried to comply as close as possible as they could.
Okay. So then the issue would be, is it the state's position that the statute saying demand for entry, the statute refers to a demand? It's the state's position that the police do not have to state police search warrant, we demand entry.
That's not my position. In the circumstance in which 803.37 applies, the police, it is very clear, have to say police search warrant and make a demand for entry. If the other elements of 803.37 are present, which includes a closed door, and there is no door in this case.
So that is your position. The state's position is that 803.37 simply does not apply because there was no door. Is that the bright line?
I think, and if there was some kind of door in this case, it was open and it was breached by Michelle Wright when she exited. But there was no door. She just came out from under the tarps. And the standard for a motion to suppress, the burden is on the defense. So to in establishing by a preponderance of the evidence that there was a door and that door was breached was never in this case.
Very well.
Thank you.
Judge Crabtree, I think you have a question.
Thank you. Mr. Fry, my question focuses on what the warrant required. Do you agree that it basically said the officers could search backpacks if the backpacks were found to be under the control of Michelle Wright? And if you do agree with that, then my follow-up questions are, who would make that finding? When was that finding made? And on what criteria was that finding made in this case? Thank you.
So I agree that the statute allowed for search of any of the backpacks found under the control of Michelle Wright. Who made that finding, I believe, would be the executing officers. And they made that finding after Samson Kiana Aina was removed from the tent. Once he was removed from the tent, you can look to Navarro and you can analyze whether or not the police had sufficient notice of ownership of the Swiss gear backpack. And what the appellant's arguing is that one of the main factors in this case that the court should look to is prototypical gender characteristics based on color and male and female gender differences of what bags look like. They're saying a camouflage Swiss gear backpack is a man's and a Hello Kitty backpack is a female's. And I think in Navarro, that was one of the three things that Navarro looked at, that a purse is a typical female bag. And in Navarro, they go in, and the home that they're going into is occupied by two men. So I think that is a little bit outdated in today's times to be relying so heavily on that. You know, proximity of the bag is important. And in this case, you had two backpacks on one bed and two people on that bed. And Kiana Aina was asleep. He was asleep next to his backpack. But Michelle Wright was also on that same bed and she exited the tent. So when you're looking at what notice the police had, how were they to know which backpack belonged to who? So Michelle Wright was in the tent and she had, this is a small area. She had control over everything that was in that tent, including both backpacks. And police, I believe, were it. Justice Wilson?
Oh, yes, please. Justice Wilson, your question. Don't forget to unmute, Eddie.
Thank you. Mr. Fry, just wanted to go back for a second to a point you made so I'm clear about it. Your view is that one of the reasons 803.37 doesn't apply is because Ms. Wright came out of the tent, right?
Yes.
So logically, wouldn't that suggest that if the police appear at a home and decide that they are or fail to comply with 803.37, but the occupant of the house comes out, that their requirement of 803.37 doesn't apply and the violation of it wouldn't have any meaning?
I think that's fact specific on every case.
If we go back to this case with the facts, it seems to be your suggestion, even if they didn't comply with and violated 803.37, whatever violation occurred was rendered moot or no longer was of significance once she came out?
I think the point on that argument would be 803.37 allows officers to enter a building when not confronted with a closed door. The door must be closed, and then they must make a demand for entry before they can break the door. In this case, Michelle Wright exited. Whatever door that was present was then open.
Well, that, I suppose, might make sense unless you add the facts that she did so after the police made it clear she was supposed to exit. She didn't do it on her own. So they exercise their power. That's what the 803.37, the title to this statute is power of officer serving. So it's supposed to regulate the power of the officer. So if the officer exercises the power in a way that doesn't comply with the statute, thereby causing the occupant to leave the residence, I wouldn't think that that would be compliance with the statute.
I don't think you have to demand for entry if you can then, if there's a way to cause the door to be open. That's exactly the fact pattern in Dixon, where they use a ruse to open the door. Once the door is open, they, as long as, you know, there's,
I don't think Dixon stands for the proposition that they, instead of complying with 803.37, they can trick the occupant to come out. They can't stand outside and say UPS, so that the occupant thinks it's UPS and they come outside. I don't think that's what DS stands for. So the ruse is not supposed to be used to circumvent 803.37.
I think when the door is open, 803.37 no longer applies because the door is open.
Well, I mean, there's a different argument that if you're suggesting it was done without a ruse, but anyways, I think the point's been made that from your point of view, it wasn't necessary to comply with 803.37 once she came out of the tent. Because I guess the door was open. I mean, this is okay.
Justice Nakayama has a follow-up.
Mr. Fry, are you stating then, inasmuch as the purpose of 803.37 is to reduce the potential of violence, prevent unnecessary property damage, and protect the right of privacy, what the officers did in this case did accomplish all those three aims?
That is abundantly clear. The officers in this case waited for 2 to 4 minutes outside of the tent of Michelle Wright and Kiana Aina. They were sitting outside the tent, looking into the tent, and saw a man that was sleeping on a bed. There was no bar to entry, and they waited until they had an affirmative statement from Michelle Wright that Kiana Aina couldn't hear. So even if there was a demand for entry, it would have been heard.
So you're saying they were respectful of... They waited for him to come out. And well, and as we know from the record, when he didn't come out, she was the one that said, hey, he's hard of hearing. You gotta go in there.
Absolutely. And there was no threat of violence. They could visibly see that he was asleep on the bed. They entered, they tapped him on the shoulder, and they asked him to leave, and he did.
Very well. Justice Wilson had a follow-up.
Yes. The fact that they don't comply with 803.37, but nobody's hurt, or that they give a lot of time to the occupant to leave the tent, does still raise the question that I'm interested in your response to, Mr. Fry, about what's supposed to be their right to privacy and the degree to which it's recognized in 803.37 by giving them demand. In other words, if there's a demand by the officers for them to leave, then they have the opportunity perhaps to prepare, or they have the opportunity to respond in a way that will diminish the possibility, for example, of violence, but also give them a chance to protect their possessions, like if this in fact was his backpack. So I'm not clear about your position on whether the right to demand is still applicable if the police officers decide not to make a demand, but then give the occupants as much time as they want to leave the dwelling.
I think my position in this case is it's clear that forcing this case to fit inside the bounds of 803.37 creates difficulty. It would create a situation where police in the future, in effectuating search warrants, are trying to strictly comply with 803.37 in circumstances that clearly, that are arguably very fact-specific and don't apply. What the more important thing in this case should be is that the police protected these individuals' right to privacy. And following the precedent set forth in Diaz in a case like this would be appropriate to do the constitutional analysis outside of the statute. Judge Crabtree?
Yeah, thank you. I'm circling back to my question about the warrant. I've been giving this a lot of thought, and I'm really not sure where I am on this. I'd like your comment. Going back to the backpack must be found to be under the control of Michelle Wright. It seems to me you're arguing something different, or at least arguably arguing something different, namely, well, the officers didn't know who the backpack belonged to, so it's okay to search it. Are those two things really the same? Are they mutually exclusive? Do they overlap or what?
I think you can look at Navarro, and the Michelle Wright had control over all of the items within that tent. I think that was clear. When you look at the evidence of the layout of the tent, she had control over everything. So the evidence shows that she had control over both backpacks. She had the ability, it was in her residence. So
you're arguing control, not ownership. Is that fair?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I understand better now. Thank you.
Justice McKenna?
Yes, thank you.
Sorry, Justice McKenna. Yeah.
Thank you. If 803.37 applies and a demand for entry had been made that the defendant might have been able to hear, and the defendant then walked out with the Swiss gear backpack, would the state have been able to seize that backpack at that point?
I'm sorry, I might have misunderstood the question. Justice McKenna, are you saying if he walked out with the backpack?
Yes, if he had heard. Because it appears he's hard of hearing, and there appears to be some dispute as to what types of announcements were made near the vicinity of the tarps at issue. If he had heard, because apparently he's not deaf, he's hard of hearing. If he had heard, and he heard the police say, search warrant, exit the tent, and he had grabbed his backpack and walked out with it, would the state have been able to seize it and search it?
I don't think so. I think in the hypothetical that Justice McKenna, you're presenting, it takes it much closer to the facts present in Navarro, and you have... there's conflicting testimony of what the officers knew before they executed the search warrant of whether or not Kiana Aina was a resident of the tent. But the fact pattern that you're presenting is that he would be an overnight visitor and he showed possession over his backpack. And I think that takes it outside of the control of Michelle Wright, takes it more in line with Navarro. But it's certainly not what the evidence in this case showed. Justice Nakayama,
your question.
You know what? I'm looking at Exhibit A to the affidavit for the search warrant. Do you have that?
I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me.
Okay, that's fine.
Mr. Frye, any further argument? And I did just want to follow up one thing on the backpack. So do you think there should be any duty on the officers to inquire, or would that be a reasonable rule in these circumstances where there is ambiguity about who controls what or who owns what?
In this case, when the officers for the other individuals at the campsite, these other 13 people were told to take their belongings and leave. That's sort of what they did. Now, there's no evidence that they did that specifically for Kiana Aina and Michelle Wright. I don't know how reasonable that would be and how that requirement would interplay with Miranda and how they would balance that. I think it might create an unworkable solution when, a search warrant is being served and you have a dangerous and dynamic environment. So I don't know. I think that would place too great of a burden on the police.
Very well. Just Takayama, your question.
Mr. Frye, did the court in Navarro address that when the court acknowledged that placing all of a visitor's possessions beyond the scope of the warrant would render searches impossible since the police could never be sure that a plausible repository for items named in the warrant belongs to a resident and actually searchable?
Yeah, yes. Yes, I believe that's still the appropriate analysis to employ. And I think when you have clear evidence that you have possessions of a visitor, those should be carved out. But to create additional burdens on police in effectuating search warrants, these are dangerous and very, very tense scenarios. And I think protecting people's privacy rights is paramount as well as safety for everyone. So less requirements allows that to be possible.
Justice Wilson, your follow-up.
Well, that's an interesting proposition, but I'm not sure it's consistent with the purpose of 803.37. In other words, 803.37 assumes that the security of the occupants of the home, as well as the agents of the government that are entering the home, are safer if there is a demand for entry and, there's an announce. It's safer than just having the entry take place without any notice to the occupants because, and for example, in this case, then the occupants could do things like make clear whatever they think needs to be made clear that's causing them anxiety. Now, in this case, as I understand it, there was, and perhaps you can correct me about this, Mr. Frye or Mr. Cox can, but I understand there was a factual dispute identified in the findings of fact and conclusions of law having to do with what Mr. Kaina Aina did. But he says he did say it was his backpack from the point of view of saying, where's my backpack when he woke up? Now, presumably, I'm not entirely sure what the circuit court did with that factual representation. But the fact that I'm pointing to is that things could be cleared up. There might be less disagreement if there's a demand made and an opportunity, therefore, for communication with the occupants of the shelter, in this case, the structure that's identified as a structure, I think, in the findings of fact and conclusions of law. Yeah, so would you agree that that's one of the purposes that is identified in the OLE and a purpose that is underlying 803.37 to provide notice so that there can be some communication?
Yes, I agree. And I think it's abundantly clear in this case, they spent 2 to 4 minutes outside of the tent doing everything they could to provide notice.
That's interesting. You say they did everything they could, but it appears that they didn't do what 803.37 was hoping would be done if it applies, which is to make a demand for entrance.
They were actually, in my opinion, they were actually doing even more than 803.37 requires. They waited outside. They had a visual view of Mr. Kiana Aina. They were speaking directly to him by name, and they were asking him to comply. They did everything that they could to protect that individual's rights.
Very well. Mr. Fry, you've reached the end of your time, but we were asking you questions during your last 5 minutes, or if you have any brief wrap-up, that would be fine before we hear from Mr. Cox.
Thank you, Chief Justice Rechtenwald. I'm okay. I yield to Mr. Cox. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you. Mr. Cox, your rebuttal.
Sorry, I had to open the mic. Thank you. Initially, the timing argument that they waited 2 to 4 minutes outside is not applicable. The timing argument kicks in after the demand. They have to wait a reasonable amount of time after the demand. No demand was made. So they're sitting outside waiting 2 to 4 minutes after they yell search warrant, police, exit your tents, is irrelevant. And under the state's argument, if all they had to do was yell search warrant, police, exit your tents, theoretically, they could have searched any tent in that whole compound. But I don't think that's even close to appropriate. As far as the need for a knock and announce, there is absolutely no evidence that the police entered the same exit that Michelle Wright used to get out of the tent. Zero evidence on that. There is clear evidence, uncontradicted, that the police had to remove a flap in order to see into the tent, and they had to move a couch in order to get access to the tent. So there is a door there that they use that is not indicated in any way, shape, or form to have been the same one that Michelle Wright used to exit. So that moving of the flap, as I argued in my written submission, is at least equal to the force necessary to turn a doorknob, which triggers the knock and demand. 8337.
Justice McKenna, your question.
Yes. I was just looking at the findings, and it says that the course finding is that the officers were using words to the effect of police search warrants and instructed those present to exit their tents. So I'm getting a little bit confused. Was there more than one warrant?
There was a personal warrant for Michelle Wright, and there was the warrant for her residence.
Okay, but they were telling people to leave their tents also.
Yes, plural.
All right, thank you.
And I think it's also important to keep in mind that with this argument about a tent, although I think the state has conceded that whether it's a tent or whatever it was covered by 803-37, if it applies. But the search warrant specifically references Michelle Wright's residence and then describes this tent structure. So I think we're all talking about the same structure.
All right. Now, a question from Justice Wilson. Justice Wilson.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Cox, we have discussed the way in which Ms. Wright left the tent, but the findings of fact, number 10, states that she left the residence voluntarily. It says her door was voluntarily open. So I wanted to have your specific response to this conclusion of law number 10.
Well, again, my response is that there's no evidence that the police used the same, quote, door, close quote, to gain entry. And number two, the evidence is clear that they had to open a flap in the tent structure in order to see in and gain access, and they had to move a couch in order to gain access through the entrance that they used. So if Michelle Wright came out, did she put the couch back? We don't know that, but it doesn't seem reasonable that they would have to move a couch and open a flap if they use the same entranceway that Michelle Wright used.
Mr. Cox, And I asked this question, Fry, also the question about whether there's anything in the record to indicate the officers had concern about their safety in terms of entering this confined space. If there was such testimony, the officer said, look, you know, that we didn't feel we could enter that space safely, so we commanded the person to exit. Is that something that's available to them if there is a legitimate concern about safety? And again, would you agree with Mr. Fry that was not articulated in the record here?
I agreed. I don't think it was articulated, but them peeking into the tent and seeing a guy sleeping on a couch or a bed, to me, indicates that they really didn't have any safety concerns that would trigger an emergency.
Very well. Thank you. Anything further at this point?
Just briefly, I think there was some indication that or some reference to Mr. Kayana being a resident of this tent. There is no such finding and there's no such evidence to substantiate that. The only evidence that even, or conclusion even comes close to that is a conclusion by the court or a finding that he had ties to this tent, but he was not a resident, so he was clearly a visitor. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Cox, Mr. Fry, for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Thank you. Malolo ia mai ne kea aha ho'okolokolo ki'ike hanohano. This honorable Supreme Court is now recessed.